This month's guest isn't just an award-winning songwriter. She is also now a published author. And it wouldn't surprise me if she's winning awards for that pretty soon. I'm Tom Maley, and this is Write You a Song. Talking to the Sky is Amy Mayo's memoir of growing up with a dysfunctional family in a small Alabama town. The book is raw, honest, harrowing at times, hilarious a lot of times, and through it all is a woman yearning to be heard, seen, and understood, and who achieved a dream she'd had since childhood of becoming a songwriter despite so many obstacles in her path. I can't recommend it highly enough. Now, the bullet points on Amy: she's a successful songwriter of hits for artists like Blake Shelton, Lone Star, Tim McGraw, Kenny Chesney, Martina McBride, Kelly Pickler, and others. She won the BMI Song of the Year Award in 2000 for co-writing Amazed with her husband Chris Lindsay and Marv Green. She also won the BMI Country Songwriter of the Year Award, becoming one of only a handful of female writers to win both awards, alongside names like Dolly, Loretta, and Taylor. Not bad for somebody who doesn't even play an instrument. And because our conversation deals a lot with her book, this is going to be unlike any interview I've done on Write You a Song. Yeah, we'll still get stories behind the songs. We'll still get insight into Amy's creative process. But I think also you're going to find by the end of the interview, you're going to be more than just a little bit inspired too. So let's get on with it. Amy Mayo, this month, right now on Write You a Song. Amy Mayo, thank you for joining us this month on Write You a Song. Your book just came out, and it is it's an incredible read. I, to be honest with you, I was thinking, it might be a fun little thing to skim through. This is a really deeply personal and really well written book.
Thank you. It took 15 years, so I rewrote it so many times, I feel like it got better, each draft until, finally I realized it could be different, but I don't know if it's, I couldn't judge it anymore. And then I had people that read, the draft I had, and the feedback was so good that I was like, okay, it's ready, and then I decided that I put it on Kickstarter to fund it, and I'm so glad I did, because, right now with the pandemic, everything's so up in the air. Had I gone, I could have went with a publisher, but it would have taken 2 years. And right now I'd be stuck in a warehouse. I know it would.
Oh, my God. The first several chapters, I just want to give you a hug. You had an unbelievable upbringing.
Yeah, I really, we would always joke that I never had met anybody with a crazier life. And it's funny because, I think a lot of the country stars kind of thought it might be a different book. When I'd be talking to them about it, Tim McGraw and Kenny Chesney were both what's in this book? They were asking a bunch of questions, and I was just it's about songwriting, kind of, but it's more everybody that's been comparing it, the books are Educated and The Glass Castle. They're more memoirs that got real popular by people that weren't famous.
If it's possible, it's a grittier version of Hillbilly Elegy.
It really is. Yeah, that's what this lady, Dana Perino, she just flipped out over the book, and she compared it to Hillbilly Elegy. And she said that, it was Hillbilly Elegy, but it was hilarious. So it's been compared, to Glass Castle, Educated, Hillbilly Elegy, and Running with Scissors.
Well, a shout out to Dana because she's a listener to the podcast, as a matter of fact. Your dad.
She's amazing.
Danny Bear Mayo was something else.
Oh, he was the biggest character. It was so hard to, try to capture his character because, the things he said, it was so hard to try to write any dialogue for him because he was just, you could never think it up. I went by things that I remembered a lot of times that he said just because it was so crazy. His mind just worked so different than everybody else I knew.
Well, and I think a lot of people have somebody like him in their family, but they kind of get stuck in the way your dad was at the very beginning where it seemed like he had all these plans, but he wouldn't follow through on them. And then he would disappear and he was unreliable. And again, I'm only a little ways into the book. He finds his footing eventually because he went on to write some pretty huge songs in Nashville. But for you at
such a critical age of development to have this man that you dearly loved not being able to rely on him. And he dearly loved you. That comes through loud and clear. But it's almost like he wasn't able to do it to the best of his abilities because he had other things, other distractions.
Yeah. We talk all the time about how, like, he had such a quality where even when he was being cruel and, like, it was almost like he couldn't help it. Like he had this endearing childlike quality that I couldn't stay mad at him, like, even when, you know, he was doing something that just was terrible.
Were you ever, you said you've been working on this book for 15 years, so you've had plenty of time to process what you were putting down. Were you ever hesitant to put this thing out and to put all this down in writing for everybody to see?
Yeah, that was a lot of the reason I think it took so long. Like, first of all, my mom and stepdad didn't know I burned our house down because I had such a bad relationship with my stepdad that I was terrified of what would happen if he found out. And so they found this out like 30 years after it happened.
Oh, wow.
And then I was really worried about my stepdad because he was so abusive to us when we were young, but he's changed. And so I didn't want to hurt him. For some reason, I really worried a lot about hurting him. And because he's tried to make up for it. He's been so different as he got older. And my kids love him. But my mom can kind of bounce back from anything. So even though there's stuff about her addiction and stuff like that, she can handle it.
I want to read something. And I mean, it's so obvious why you do what you do, because you're an amazing writer. If you don't mind, I just want to read one of the paragraphs that caught my attention.
Sure.
For anybody listening, just listen to the description. You paint such a vivid picture. In my first memory, I'm 2 years old, standing in a woman's living room that smells like dirty diapers and garbage. I don't know if she had a sign on her door that said white trash daycare, but she kept a lot of the kids in our trailer park. The phone kept ringing, and I felt a sense of alarm in the air. Snotty-nosed children were crying, and parents came to pick up their kids, scooping them up like a kangaroo in the pouch, but no one came to get me. So the faceless woman threw me on her hip and put me in her car. I thought I was going with her, but she stopped in front of our trailer, got me out of the back seat, and sat me on the rotting front steps of our mobile home. She held a cigarette between her teeth as she buttoned up my red coat. Sit on these steps and do not move. Your mama or daddy will be home soon.
Yeah, that made me emotional listening to you read it.
Wow.
Yeah, the thing about the book is that, like, as it goes, like, there's so many twists and turns, like, because my childhood was so crazy, and, like, we were technically homeless lots of times in my childhood, and then my daddy went on to make millions, and then he died homeless. And after I tried, you haven't got this far yet, but I tried to kill myself when I was 19, and I almost succeeded. I mean, like, it's a miracle I'm even here. And after that, I just, like, decided, you know, I was going to find a way to get to Nashville one way or the other. And then when I got to Nashville, within 6 months, I was married to a guy who was beating me up and bit me in the face and just had myself in such a mess that I didn't know how to get out of it. So I've always hoped that, like, this book would help people, like, that were in abusive marriages or just bad marriages or that just felt lost in their life and they just had this vision of who they were going to be and what they wanted their life to be and they were nowhere near it. That like was my dream, that it would help people.
Well, even the name of the book, Talking to the Sky, is a reference to how you would spend your countless hours in your room by yourself with your notebooks and your poetry and not much else, and you would just gaze out that window and you would talk to the sky. You would share your dreams. I don't know if you were praying or just talking to yourself or what it was, but you were hanging on to something. Did you know at that time what it was you were hanging on for? Does that make sense?
It yeah it just felt like when I would pray, a lot of times, like the night that I tried to kill myself, I was outside just staring up at the stars. Like, and in Alabama during those days, you could see the Milky Way. And like, I just remember it just seemed like the most magical thing, you know, like, and the biggest place and where you could talk to God. Like some people may think, you know, talk to the universe. It just seemed like where prayers should go. You know what I mean? Like that. And so I always did that. And then when I was in that horrible marriage, we had a tiny backyard and I would go out there and just pray, you know, God, please get me out of here. I didn't see a way out, but I just prayed that I could find a way out.
Your dad, for as chaotic as he was for much of your life, did he, by going to Nashville and becoming a successful songwriter, sort of show you a way out?
Well, he never really encouraged me about being a songwriter. I think it took a while for me to realize why, because at the time I thought he was being mean. But then as I got older and when I was writing this book, I realized he just was trying to he didn't want me to get my hopes up and get my heart broken. Because when I moved to Nashville, like it was in the early 90s, I didn't even know of another female songwriter that wasn't like Dolly Parton or Loretta Lynn, that wasn't writing for their own records. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't know any women that were just songwriters. Most everybody, like when I got signed, I was the only female in the building, and there was multiple publishing companies like in our building. And so it was very rare. There's so many things about like that I didn't realize how big of an underdog story it was, because like I'm not a musician. I don't even play an instrument, which that's, you know, another crazy thing. And then as like my dad told me I was tone deaf. So actually, in a lot of ways, he hurt me more than he helped me when it came to songwriting, because I believed him, because he said, if you're tone deaf, you don't know you're tone deaf. And so I was terrified to sing in front of anyone. And then it took my husband now, Chris, we wrote together for years, but he said, I want you to sing this demo. And then when I did, people loved it. And like Martina McBride, that's how I met her. She's like, I love your voice, you know, and she tried to get Joe Galani to sign me to a record deal, but my voice is very weird. Like if I sing a demo, nobody cuts it. Nobody records it. Like it's just too weird. And I did get offered a record deal by this guy in LA that he signed a bunch of rock people. Like he signed Aerosmith and AC/DC and like a bunch of big rock bands. And he called one day and he had heard this song of mine called Liar. And he was like, I want to sign you to a record deal. He had the whole thing visioned out how it would be. But that morning I had found out, like probably 3 hours before he called, I had found out I was pregnant with my second son. And I just never, that was never my dream to be tour around and sing on stage. I get real nervous singing. I would rather talk if I was going to be on stage than sing.
So you went to Nashville.
I'm always worried.
To be a songwriter without any musical ability at all, really.
Yeah, I did. What's weird is like there's a lot of weird little things. Like if I'm ever in a writing appointment and we're on a melody of another song, I always pick it up before there. I don't know if anybody's ever like picked it up, you know. I can always spot it when we're on another melody. I don't know what if that's because I'm just listening to it. But then after a while, I realized I had really great melodies that people were telling me, I love your melodies. Like, and a lot of times if somebody is like, if they're not the, like we call them like the top liner, you know, if they're not the top liner, most people don't know what exactly they're doing in that melody. Like, do you know Liz Rose?
Yes. Yeah. She's been on the podcast. Yeah.
She's a great example, like, because she has great melodies, but she's not technically a singer. So I loved seeing her perform live, kind of seeing what she did. But it's weird because, like, if I sing my melody, it sounds like one thing. And then if I get somebody like Caitlin Smith or somebody on it, it's a whole different song because they're such great singers. I mean, it just turns into something else.
So was your dad alive to see you begin to have success?
Yeah, I could cry even thinking, like, he died right before. He didn't get to see me win, like, Song of the Year at the BMI Awards or Songwriter of the Year at the BMI Awards, but he did get to see our song Amazed. It was, like, at the top of the chart, and one of the last times I saw him, he got he was broke. I mean, he couldn't afford a coat. It was so sad because I'd seen him win awards on TV and stuff, and he was living at this rundown motel, and when we went to drop him off, he loved to go to the movies. So we took him to a movie, and we went to drop him back off, and he's like, I got something for you. And so he went over to his car, and he got out this stack of newspapers. It was like the size of a microwave. I mean, just this giant. And he came over there, and they had featured me in the Songwriter Showcase, and he bought every one of the papers.
Oh, my gosh.
He was really proud. And Brandi Clark, you probably know her too, a songwriter and artist.
She's been on the podcast too, yeah.
Oh, she has? Yeah. I love her. She told me that she met my dad when she first moved to town, and he just was talking about how proud he was of me. And, like, so he didn't tell it to me, but he was telling it to a lot of people.
And just so people can make the connection, your dad again was Danny Bear Mayo, and he's credited probably his three most well-known songs, Keeper of the Stars, which I think was one of the most played songs on country radio in the 1990s. I tip my hand to the Keeper of the Stars. Alabama's If I Had You, which is just a beautiful ballad. And there's nothing. No, there's nothing that I wouldn't do. If I had me. And Feed Jake from Pirates of the Mississippi. If I die before I wake, feed Jake. He's been a good dog, my best friend, right through it all. If I die before I wake, feed Jake. And he wrote a bunch of other just terrific songs, but those are probably the three standouts. When you started to see him have success, based on how he was when you were growing up, were you surprised, or was it just sort of like, well, why not? He's, you know, everything else has happened in his life.
Yeah, he did so much crazy stuff that, like, I don't know that I was that, like, I don't remember being that surprised, because he went from being, like, crazy broke to, like, he opened this chain of video stores. He borrowed money from my granddad, and then he had had a lot of success with that. And then he moved to Nashville. And the crazy thing is, he didn't play an instrument either, which is so rare. I don't know, like, I've probably only met two or three songwriters in my career that didn't play it, especially men that didn't play an instrument.
He had a way with words, and you have a way with words.
Yeah, that's what I realized. Like, I wasn't in Nashville that long before I realized every time we get in the room to write a song, we are never stuck on the music. Everybody's full of music. We're always stuck on the idea. I mean, like, because if you have, like, three great songwriters with a great idea, you're going to have a killer song. But if you have you could have the three most talented songwriters in Nashville and just not really have an idea, and you're not going to have a good song.
That's an interesting perspective. I haven't heard it put that way before, but that makes sense. Somebody can be much stronger musically than they can be lyrically.
Yeah, and, like, a lot of times, like, that's what happens. Like, whenever you get in the room with an artist, like, you know, like if you're writing with Kenny Chesney or something, you know that, okay, if we write a great song, he's going to record it, you know, and that's when it really, you really need that idea. Because, like, there's an example of an idea, like, I love songs that are like little stories. And I always wanted to write a song about a dog after my dad had Feed Jake, because I saw the impact it had on people. Like, and I love dogs. So I had this idea for like 4 years, and I tried to talk everybody into writing it. I mean, I was like, this idea is so weird. I don't care. I'll just send you the lyric I'm working on. Like, and I just sent it to like 20 different writers. And I got the idea from Jaron Johnson, because he did this post on Instagram when his dog died. And around the same time, I had lost my dog. And I thought, like, you know, there's a huge song in this, because when people lose their dog, it's like they're embarrassed to talk about it, but it's such a deep and personal loss. Like, they're your best friend. I mean, a lot of times, they'll move to town with you. They'll be with you when you're broke, when you go through a breakup. You know, they're always there. And so it's such a deep loss when you lose your dog. And this song, if you haven't heard it, it's just so good. Tim McGraw cut it. Like, the crazy thing is, we wrote this song finally. I finally talked Jaron Johnson into writing it. And I wrote it with him and Tom Douglas and Tom's daughter, Claire. And I had to lure Jaron into it with Tom Douglas, because I knew that he had written hits with Tom, and that Tom's like his favorite songwriter. So I told Tom, I've got a song of the year idea, and I can't get Jaron to write it. So he called Jaron, and then Tom messaged me, you want to write it in the morning? So we wrote that song, and it was cut really fast. Like, I sent it, I pitched it a couple places, and then Tim McGraw was done with his record, but he went back in and recorded it. And the response, like, I've only had one other song where people cried. Like, I get texts all the time, this song made me cry so hard.
The Silverado seat feels empty without you in it. I still fly down them dirt roads we used to ride down. Gets my good gear spinning. Might get your name in a tattoo. Talk on. I miss you. This king-size bed has too much space without you in it. I wander around watercolor memories. My head is spinning. I think I'll get that tattoo. Doggone, I miss you. If there's one spot of sun on the porch up there, I bet you're lying right in it. Yeah, if angels wear red wing boots, I bet one turns up missing. If there's a Chevy, I bet your shotgun in. There's a mailman, I bet he's running. If there's hunting and fishing in heaven, I hope the good Lord lets you tag along. Talk on it, amen. Talk on man's best friend. Waiting to catch that first yellow bus, yeah.
That song is just, to me, is just so sweet, like, about the, like, your dog being in heaven. But it was hard to get somebody to write it, because it is a little bit crazy, you know, to write a song about losing your dog. And like, it took a few turns I didn't see that I think made it better once we all got together writing it.
I want to talk to you about another song that is universally loved. Before I do, though, I actually had a chance to talk to Marv Green, your co-writer, and I wanted to play for you. Let me know if you can hear this, okay? I'm going to play it down the line
okay.
for you. And this is Marv, several months back on the podcast, talking about how you guys wrote a fairly popular little ditty.
So this is 1998. I just met my wife and Amy Mayo, Chris Lindsay, my co-writers, were falling in love with each other. And Amy, You know, it's funny because Amy and I kind of landed in Nashville around the same time, and so we'd hang out and go listen to other songwriters and just talk about music, and went to, you know, go to some parties and just play each other what we were up to. And she recognized in a sisterly way when I met Tasha that Tasha kind of had my number, and so she called me, and, you know, she'd kind of just egg me on as a sister would, and she called me one night, and I don't know, she was completely serious but also having fun with me, and she's from Gaston, Alabama, and so in this Alabama kind of voice, she said, "Marv, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just, you know, back at my apartment now." And she goes, "Well, tonight I want to write a love song." And she was laughing. And I was like, "Oh, you do, do you?" And she said, "Yeah, why don't you come over?" And I said, "All right, I'll come over." And so we just...
And there you go. That was...
Oh, I love that so much. Marv is so awesome. Oh, I love that. You know, I have always said, and I still feel it every time, there, that song Amazed, like, he was falling in love with Tasha, I was falling in love with my husband Chris, and that feeling got inside Amazed. Like, right when that steel guitar does that real thing, you can feel it in the song. Like, you can feel the emotion in the song, because I probably had most of my hits, or not most, a lot of my hits have been love songs. Like, before Chris and me got married, I wrote that song with Bill Luther, My Best Friend, like, and kind of gave it to him. And then he wrote me a song back that was I Want to Be Your Everything by Keith Urban. Mm-hmm. And, like, so we would write these love songs back and forth. And we all wrote Let's Make Love with Marv and Bill Luther. And I just love love songs. I grew up on Lionel Richie, and I just love love songs. But the crazy thing is, it's really hard to write a good love song, because there is nothing cheesier than a bad love song. it's so, like, after Amazed, everybody I wrote with wanted to write a love song. And I've got probably 200 terrible love songs, like, just trying to, like... I would get with somebody like Bon Jovi, and they want to write a love song, and then it would be like, it would be some title that, like, would never work. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. and that everybody that I worked with, that's what they wanted to do, is write a love song. And so my catalog is full of them, but they don't have that energy like Amazed and the other two that were real.
Every time our eyes meet, this feeling inside me, it's almost more than I can take. Baby, when you touch me, I can feel how much you love me, and it just blows me away. I've never been this close to anyone or anything. I can hear thoughts, see your dreams. I don't know how you do what you do. I'm so in love with you. It just keeps getting better. I want to spend the rest of my life with you by my side, forever.
And I wanted to ask you about My Best Friend. You mentioned that in the opening lines. It sounds like it's pulled straight from your life, a page from your book. I never had no one that I could count on. I've been let down so many times.
Yep. I'll tell you something crazy. When we were writing that song, I had never had a Tim McGraw cut, but he was my target, like, pretty much from the get-go. I just loved his records. And so we were writing that song. Bill had never had a Tim McGraw cut either. We had had a few, like, songs, and I'd had a couple singles, but they were on smaller artists. And so when we were writing it, after that came straight out of my diary, those lyrics, the whole first verse pretty much. And I told Bill when we were writing the song, I was like, I think Tim McGraw's going to cut this. And then a couple months later, after he had recorded it, he said that he knew when he heard, he got through. He named the exact lyrics that you just did. He said he knew that he was going to record it after he heard just that part. And the crazy thing is that song made the Bad Grammar Hall of Fame. Because I never had no one. It's right in the first line.
I never had no one that I could count on. I've been let down so many times. I was tired of hurting, so tired of searching, till you walked into my life. Was a feeling I'd never known. And for the first time, I didn't feel alone. You're more than a lover. There can never be another to make me feel the way you do. I look at you. I don't know where I'd be without you here with me. Life with you makes perfect sense. You're my best friend. You're my best friend.
But you know what? You're speaking in the vernacular. At a time like this, you don't want to, you know, mess with things like proper grammar, because that's not necessarily how people speak.
Yeah, it's true. It's like in the book, I realized, like, people, like, it's really crazy. If you sit at the table, like, next time you're just sitting at the table with a few people, I've really paid attention. I learned it in a writing class, but everybody's kind of in their own world. Like my husband last night at dinner, he's talking about Elon Musk and some rocket that's taken off, and that's all he's talking about. Then my daughter, she was talking about going to the beach. Everybody's there. The dialogue between everybody, they're just kind of in their own world, like if you really pay attention. And everybody talks like kind of slang. They say ain't and you know, and don't. It's a whole different kind of thing when you really listen to people.
I think a lot of times you fall back on from where you grew up. And I catch myself, you know, when I'm with my friends. I grew up in a small town in Washington State. And, yeah, I fall back on just kind of casual, comfortable language. you're off the clock. Who's paying attention?
Yeah, it's so true. Like, in my accent, when I first moved to Nashville, I mean, it was so country that, like, people couldn't understand me. Over the last 20 years, it's changed a lot. But, like, when I first, the first time I went to New York, I got in the back of a cab, and I told them, like, where I wanted to go. And the guy turned around, and he's like, what language are you speaking? I mean, he didn't know, like, he didn't understand me at all. This was like before, like I finally got to the point where I would just write it down and hand them a piece of paper because, no, I got lost every time I got in the taxi back then.
I want to ask you specifically about some of your songs. Just give me your thoughts about them, okay?
Okay.
Every time I hear that song, Blake Shelton.
That song we wrote with the Warren Brothers, and that song we were talking about how, like, you know, in all of our memories, we have like a little soundtrack of, like, if I hear that song Heaven by Bryan Adams, I just kind of smell the gym room floor and a leather jacket, my first dance, you know, like it just takes me right back to then. And then if you hear a song like that you had played at your wedding, or, you know, you have these little songs that mean something to you that nobody else knows.
There's something about yesterday. How fast it all flies away. I don't know what it is about a goodbye kiss that makes you want to stay. We were crazy, then we were over. We were breaking up, making love a runaway roller coaster.
You mentioned this in your book. There's a couple of Queen songs that you mentioned. And I think both times that you reference those songs, you reference how to this day when you hear those songs, you're right back in that moment.
It's so true. Like, I remember, like, perfectly and vividly the first time I met my stepdad with my mom, because they got married. I'd met him twice. I mean, like, we didn't even know. They had to go to a different state because the divorce wasn't even close to final. And I remember getting picked up by him, and we were in like a Trans Am with the T-tops out, and Another One Bites the Dust came on. And that's the first time I heard that song. And I just remember like flying out of the driveway with that playing.
What about This One's for the Girls? Where did that song come from? That's a very empowering song. When you wrote it, did you feel like you needed to share this message?
Yeah, that song, I loved Cyndi Lauper growing up. And this one's for the girls, kind of. I wanted to write a song like girls just want to have fun, but I wanted to put a little more of a message in it than like girls just want to have fun. It's kind of just like a little party song, you know, that all girls love. But I wanted to kind of say something in there about, like, you know, with girls, like, especially now, there's no girls on the radio. It's so sad to me. But like, it's such a great anthem for girls. And one of my favorite writers ever, Maya Angelou, one time she called me and she said she thanked me for writing that song, which I couldn't even believe I was talking to her.
What?
She was like, that's such an empowering song for girls and women. And I was just on cloud nine talking to her.
Just hang it up after that. I mean,
yeah.
Wow.
It blew me away. I could not believe it.
This is for all you girls about 13. High school can be so rough, can be so mean. Hold on to you.
Another really, really beautiful, touching, sensitive song that I think can mean different things to different people. Kenny Chesney's Who You'd Be Today.
Yeah, that song, it's that song and then the dog song are the ones that I get, like, every couple months I'll get a letter or something about Who You'd Be Today from somebody that'll just break your heart. Like, that song was about one of my best friends, he's in the book. His name's Jerry, and we used to dream of moving to Nashville together. We were just friends, but he was the one person in my town that I knew would really do it, would really move. And he got sick and had cancer and died like at 22. And it's so weird because we were writing, my husband Chris and me were writing with Chris Stapleton. And this was like 15 years ago. And when Chris Stapleton, I didn't know Chris Stapleton at the time. And when he walked in our studio and I saw him, I mean, I just froze because he looked just like my friend Jerry, if Jerry had lived to, you know, to be 30.
Sunny days seem to hurt the most. I wear the pain like a heavy coat. I feel you everywhere I go. I see your smile, I see your face. I hear you laughing in the rain. I still can't believe you're gone. It ain't fair you died too young, like a story that hadn't just begun. But death tore the pages all away. God knows how I miss you, all the hell that I've been through. Just knowing no one could take your place. Sometimes I wonder who you'd be today.
And is that where the impetus of the song came from, right at that sort of moment?
Yeah, that's when I got the idea. Like, a lot of times, most of my ideas are little stories, like Who You'd Be Today, or the dog song, or This One's for the Girls, or, like, they're little stories, like, kind of like, every time I hear that song, they're kind of like just little, you know, they could be an article or something. That's one thing that I think, you know, like Amaze. I was so upset when we wrote Amaze. We were all arguing in the studio because I was like, this song doesn't even have a title. The publisher named it Amaze. We were calling it I'm Amazed by You, but then somebody shortened it to Amaze, and it was so much better.
Another song, you talk about story songs, and it's like a short story, and I'm also assuming that this refers to the places you grew up, the people you knew, Drugs or Jesus.
Yes, that like is my hometown in a nutshell. Like, I went to one of the wildest moments, like, as a songwriter. We were in Alabama, in my hometown, and I was in Jack's, which is like a Burger King or something, and that song came on the radio, and it was so powerful hearing it, you know, in Gadsden, where I grew up, because it's really heartbreaking. There's so, in that town, like, the Goodyear plant used to, everybody worked there, and they shut that plant down, and I mean, it's so sad how a part of the town died with it.
My hometown, for anyone who sticks around, you're either lost or you found. There's not much in between. In my hometown, everything's still black and white. It's a long, long way from wrong to right. From Sunday morning to Saturday night, everybody just wants to get high. Watch a perfect world go by. We're all looking for love and meaning in our lives. We follow the roads that lead us to drugs or Jesus.
Could you have become the writer that you are without the chaos in your life growing up?
I don't think so. Like, the first line, my favorite line in the book says, all my greatest gifts have come wrapped in ribbons of pain. Mm-hmm. And I realized it's so true as a writer because I got my first diary 5 minutes after my dad shot himself. Like, my grandmother let me unwrap a present. And that's been the love of my life. And then when my mom married my stepdad, he kept me grounded for 3 straight years. And, a total of 3 years. There were breaks in between. But so I spent all my time in my bedroom writing, and I think it gave me a huge head start. Like, when I got to Nashville, I probably had 10,000 song titles, like, just that I had been making since the sixth grade. And so that was such a painful time for me. And that's where, like, I think I really bloomed as a writer during those years.
Well, Amy Mayo, this has been an absolute joy speaking with you. And I am not, like, blowing smoke in any way, shape, or form. Your book is excellent, and I encourage, even though it's after Christmas, if you're going to get yourself an after Christmas present and buy this book. It is fantastic. It's called Talking to the Sky, 15 years in the making, a lifetime putting it together. And I want to go out on this interview, if you wouldn't mind sharing the story of the first time you ever really wrote a song, and it was with your dad. And we actually have a copy of the recording, so if you could just set this up. I think that's the way we'll take the interview out.
Oh, I love that. Nobody's ever heard this song. It's never been played anywhere like this. So when I was 8 years old, my parents got divorced, and I didn't see my dad for a little while. And then the first time that I saw him, we went to a movie, and we went to see the Buddy Holly story. And in that movie, I saw him write a song. And so when I was mesmerized. I'd never really thought about where songs came from. And so when we got in the car to go up to my grandmother's that night, I told him, I was like, I'm going to be a songwriter when I grow up. And he said, well, what makes you think you can do that? And I said, because I got a title. And so then I told him my title, and it was If Only I Could Hold You Again, I'd Never Let You Go. And so then he just looked at me, and then he said, I'd always let you know that you had a friend if only I could hold you again. And I didn't realize till I was writing this book that I was talking about him, because him and my mom had gotten divorced. But he was talking about my mom. So, like, there's lines in there where he's talking directly to my mom.
But then your dad went out and recorded it and actually hired musicians and then gave this to you as a present.
Yes, he came in. The first time he ever came to the house that I lived in with my mom and stepdad, he came in with a little shoebox, and he was like, I got a surprise for you. And so when he handed me that little shoebox and I opened it, it was full of little 45 records, and I pulled one out, and then I realized it said on it, If Only I Could Hold You Again. And then it said Amy Mayo and Danny Mayo under it. And that, from that moment, that's when I knew that I wanted to be a songwriter. That's all I ever wanted to be. When I saw my name on that little record, it was just a demo, but to me it was a record.
And it's him singing, and he gave you top billing.
Yes, yes. And it's him singing. It's one of the few recordings I have of him singing.
I'd never let you go. I'd always let you know you had a friend. If only I could hold you again. If only I could touch you again. I kiss your doubts away. I'd love you every day until the end. Only I could touch you again. You and I could have made it, but my lies got in.
Again, much for taking time. This has been awesome. You are a light burning bright.
I have loved every minute of it. This has been a great talk.
If only I could lay with you again, I wouldn't come in with the morning sun after leaving another one. Oh, not again.
Write You a Song is a production of Bonneville International Communications and KNCI Radio in Sacramento. I'm your host, Tom Maley. Big thank you to my daughter, Emma Rose Maley, who helped line up our interview with Amy Mayo. A while back, I was talking to Emma about how hard it can be to track down top-tier songwriters as guests month after month after month. And then she reminded me that, she works at a talent agency in L.A., so she's going to start helping put together more interviews for her dear old dad. I knew there was a reason she's my favorite daughter. And it's not just because she's my only daughter. Now, all that said, Write You a Song is going to take a bit of a break. I've been cranking these things out every single month now for over 2 years, and it is a joy, but it also is a lot of work. I'm going to step back, take a bit of a breather, let Emma work on some future guests, and then we'll get back at it sometime in spring. Maybe sooner. For updates, follow me on Twitter at KNCI Tom. It's just at KNCI Tom. And in the meantime, there are, I think, 27 other podcasts in the archives, and if you're a songwriting geek at all, they are all worth a listen. Every single one of them, and it has nothing to do with me. They're all great guests. So with that, thank you for downloading, subscribing, listening. Be good, and we'll talk to you again in a few months.